I remember being able to climb trees before I'd ever seen a house with more than two floors. I remember walking in mud and puddles and walking through streams before I'd ever sat in a car. I remember climbing a tree because I saw a lizard before I'd ever eaten a cheeseburger. The best things in life are on the other side of fear. And I want everyone to just think about that. If it frightens you, there's probably something good on the other side of that.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
From a childhood close to nature in Jamaica, to a youth marked by violent experiences in England, to an unforgettable walk to the North Pole that would change everything. That's pretty much how you could describe the life of Duane Fields in a nutshell, the first Brit of color to reach the North Pole on foot. Since his march to the North Pole, one adventure followed the next. Most recently, the presenter, explorer, and naturalist traveled to the most extreme regions of our planet in his new National Geographic series, The Seven Toughest Days. In it, he travels to icy Kyrgyzstan, he crosses the rainforests in Gabon, and hikes through the Omani Desert. Prior to that, he took Will Smith to Iceland in the Disney Plus series Welcome on Earth, overcoming icy waters and an Icelandic glacier with him. In addition to being an adventurer, Duane now works as one of the UK's leading scout ambassadors. Moreover, he is one of the co-founders of the hashtag We2 Foundation that attempts to bring young people from inner city hotspots closer to the natural world and all its beauty, and to highlight what is threatening that beauty today. To date, he has received numerous honors, including an invitation to Buckingham Palace and the Freedom of the City of London Award. So, as you can see, Duane has a lot to talk about. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's get started. Hi, Duane. Welcome to our show. Thank you so much for making the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome. You guys rock, man. How could I not make the time?
That is very kind of you. I would like to start our conversation by learning a little bit about you as a person. And I'd love to talk about where it all started for you, which is in Jamaica, of course, where you were born. Would you take us back to the place where you grew up? What comes to your mind spontaneously when you think back to your childhood in Jamaica?
What comes to mind instantly as I think about my childhood in Jamaica is me running around barefooted in woodlands and fields and forests near my house. I think about me looking at every single animal and wondering what it would be like to have that as a pet or what it'd be like to know everything about that animal. I mean, all my family back home would tell you, all the elders, the grandmas and great grandmas would have told you when they were still here. I was a feral child. I spent most of my time, every single moment I could, outside, and I would bring back frogs and I'd bring back lizards and I'd bring back cicada beetles. And if it moved, I would bring it back home and I'd want to care for it and look after it and learn more about it. That's who I was as a kid.
And was that usual back then? Were your friends like you? Was that part of growing up where you grew up, or were you special in that regard?
So spending time outdoors for a kid in Jamaica, especially where I grew up in rural Jamaica, it's pretty normal. You'd be outdoors, you'd be playing outside, you'd make your toys. But I think I was at the extreme end of that. I think where everyone else had a pet dog or a cat maybe in their house, I had those and a pig and a parrot and other birds. And if it moved, generally, I'd bring it home. I was this kid who, even amongst wild children, I was very, very wild and very, very feral. I just didn't feel happy unless I was, you know, climbing to the highest branches of a tree. You know, that moment where you're there and you realize that the branch might just be a bit too weak for you and it's swinging a little bit. And I'd always want to just go a little bit higher, or I'd be crossing, I don't know, a stream. And rather than walk along the usual path that people'd use, I'd be upstream or downstream of that, trying to find a new route through. I just felt more comfortable walking into the unknown a little bit. And it also made me feel more confident as well. Every time I climbed that branch to the highest point, I felt like I'd achieved something and I was now stronger and more ready for the next thing that came along.
And how did your family think about that? Like, I think you grew up with your great grandma, right? Did they try to stop you or to manage you in any way, or were they encouraging in your endeavors of early explorations, if you want to call it like that?
I love how you phrase it. So my great grandma and my great aunt, they were, I lived with them until I was almost 7 years old. And the one thing I can say to you is, they didn't necessarily encourage it, but they didn't dissuade me from doing it either. I'd go out, I'd be scratched, I'd be bitten, I'd be stung, scraped, I'd be, you know, as a kid, these are things that were normal for me. And I think they just accepted that that's who I was and that's the kind of conditions I'd be in. They knew the worst thing they could do was to tell me to sit down in a corner and not do anything. Mm. I remember I'd go back to my great grandma. I ran back to my great grandma once after I'd been stung by a swarm of hornets. I was climbing a tree. I fell out the tree, fell into a bush, and in the bushes was a hornet's nest. And I remember I ran back. I'd been stung, you know, a good few times, and I was really ill. And the next day when I was patched up and ready to go, there wasn't a mention of it. It was just, be careful, off you go. I'd walk back into the house from time to time and I'd say, you know, granny or auntie, I need the knife. And they wouldn't say, nope, as a 5-year-old or as a 6-year-old, you can't have the knife. What they'd say is, do not break the knife. And they'd let me go on my way. So I think I was a bit unfair when I said they didn't encourage it, because they really did. They gave me all the tools I needed to kind of pursue my interests in the outdoors. And they never once tried to stop me. And I think that's why I am who I am today.
Yeah, that really sounds like a childhood that was characterized by a huge, and from today's perspective, from my perspective, by an extraordinary amount of freedom.
Oh, yes.
However, eventually, one day, you left that world of almost total freedom and you left for England, for a faraway place. Why did you leave?
So, you've characterized it perfectly. It was a childhood that was built around freedom. I could come and I could go and I could test myself. And I think when you're a child with those, that responsibility of knowing, you know, what you're capable of or what you're not capable of and where your strengths lie, I think that puts you in a really confident and capable position. Now, I left and moved to live with my mother in England. She'd lived here. She was born in England, in actual fact. And she'd been backwards and forwards from Jamaica to England and back again for a few years. And eventually she'd settled there and decided that, you know, the decision was made that I would go and live with her. One, because of the opportunities, and two, because my great grandmother and my great aunt were getting really old, maybe too old to look after an energetic young 7-year-old kid. And, you know, I moved to London, which was a completely different place. If you imagine as a kid, like I said, I'm so free. The moment I'm awake, I am out the door. I'm out there. I'm playing all day. I'm building things. I'm using a knife. I'm using a cutlass, whatever tools I needed. I'd find a way to get it and use it. And then I moved to London, where you're encouraged as a kid. Well, I certainly was, to stay inside the house, and you're encouraged to not play with sharp objects. And you're encouraged to not throw stones, and you're told not to do so much. Whereas, and it was a very, very different world to the one that I'd lived in. This world of absolute freedom had now come to a full stop. And the worst thing you could do to a kid like me, say, sit in the corner and, you know, sit in the corner and watch TV. It just doesn't work for me. It doesn't sit right in my head. And I remember just feeling really stressed and borderline depressed as a kid, because I was being asked to go against everything that I'd known or experienced up until that point in my young life. And also, I move in to live with a mother who doesn't actually know me. I mean, up until this stage, I think I'd seen my mother maybe 2, possibly 3 times. So she doesn't know who I am, what I'm capable of. I don't know who she is or what she's, you know, willing to encourage or dissuade. And if I'm honest, it was a really, really tough time for me, because the worlds were one so completely different, but I didn't feel like I had the support to deal with that difference as well.
Yeah, that does sound very challenging, because evidently being in nature and with nature and understanding nature was a huge part not only of the environment that you grew up in, but also of your identity. It was what gave you confidence. You knew your place in that kind of world. And now suddenly you were in this massive city. I read interviews where you described that you almost desperately looked for trees or forests or some kind of green, and there was such a lack of it that it was really sad. And Another thing that comes to mind is you talked about earlier on about your passion for all kinds of animals, small animals, big animals, and that you eventually also tried in, to some degree to share that passion and love with your new big city friends. But their response also wasn't really what you were hoping for.
Yeah, so I remember being a kid, and this was in the first few weeks, possibly month or so since of me arriving in the UK. And again, remember, I'm this passionate kid, whether it's a bug or whether it's a beetle or a bird, I love it. Mammals, reptiles, whatever it is, I just love wildlife and nature. And I remember I was really struggling when I first came to the UK. So I'm you know, in infant school, which is up until age 7. And I remember I was so desperate to make friends. And I thought to myself, well, I know I have this passion for the for nature, natural, for the natural world. I'm going to share that with the kids in my school. And I remember I walked into the school gardens and I lifted up a log and I picked up some wood lice and some other insects that were underneath the log. And I thought I would share this with these other kids. And sure enough, they looked at me and they looked at my hands and they saw these creepy crawlies in my hands and they screamed and ran away and called me all sorts of names. And for me, that was just another part of young Dwayne Fields being ebbed away, because I felt like in those moments, I felt like, I can't be myself. These kids don't appreciate nature the way I do. They don't like the world, the natural world, the way I do. And as a kid, you know, you try to conform, you try to fit in. So you end up giving up the things that you really like because it doesn't help you fit in. And I gave up a little bit of myself in that moment. I remember, you know, I loved making my own toys. And it was when, whether it's a push cart or a swing or whatever it was. And it was when I first came to the UK that I realized that actually most people bought toys. And a box isn't really a toy, even though I had much more fun with a box, for example, than I would do with, I don't know, at the time, a tennis racket. It just, to me, all of these things just compounded and made me feel like maybe being yourself isn't really going to cut it in this new world. Maybe just try and do what everyone else does and like the things they like. And I ended up giving up on all the things that I liked and all the things I was passionate about for a long time, all the way through my teens, of course, certainly through my teens and into my early 20s.
I think one of the goals that most of us have in life, consciously or unconsciously, is trying to find out what we are truly passionate about. And many of us look for the answer to that question their whole life. It's not that obvious for everyone. And it's a huge privilege to be able to identify that passion and that skill set that means something to you. And you, I don't know if it was very conscious back then when you were small, but you already had found your world that you felt good and right in. And now you had to bury it.
Absolutely.
And be someone else.
And I think just to add to that, many of us look for our passions to be given the stamp of approval by everybody else. And somewhere between, you know, the ages of 9, 20, 10, 11, when you're just going through puberty and you're desperate to be accepted and you're desperate to be part of something, you give up on your passion. And I mean, I did it, and it's probably the biggest regret of my life, because again, I was young. I didn't know any better. But I honestly, if there's one magic wish that I'd have, is that every kid that found their passion never thought they had to give it up to please anybody else or to please the majority. Because, look, I'm very fortunate. I've now gone back to my first love, which is natural spaces, the outdoors, exploration. I've gone back to it now, and not everybody gets that opportunity. So I'm very fortunate. And equally, I think every kid out there, they know what they love. But what happens is they go to school or their group of friends say, oh, actually, that's not that cool. When in actual fact, to the individual, it's the coolest thing in the world. And we just need to instill a sense of confidence in themselves as early as we can.
Yeah, so that was definitely a challenging time. And it lasted for many years. You already mentioned that, until your teens and your early 20s. And I believe one of the incidents that was life-changing in the regard that you afterwards decided to change a few things happened in 2005. Would you describe that moment for us? What happened there, and how far did that influence how you thought about yourself and about how your priorities in life?
So just to give you a little bit of a lead into this, all through my teens, I had been behaving in a way that I wouldn't say I was badly behaved, but what I was doing was I was saying yes to things that Dwayne inside didn't actually agree with. And it could be something as small as everybody that I was around. So my group of friends, my peer group saying, we should go, let's go to the shop. Now, I didn't necessarily want to go to the shop, but I'd say, yeah, let's go to the shop because that's what was socially accepted then. And I carried on that pattern of behavior across all of my teens, actually. Some days we'd sit down on a bench for 4 or 5 or 6 hours and we'd laugh at jokes that weren't funny. And I'd sit there and I'd laugh because I wanted to be part of something. I didn't want to be isolated. Now, the incident that I think we're talking about is the one where I'd spent months in my shed throughout winter building a moped. And I bought some parts. I went to a scrapyard and got some parts. I searched for parts in the newspapers and online. And I built this moped from absolute scratch. Now, I rode this moped after I thought I was finished building it. And I accidentally crashed it because I didn't build it properly. I turned left and the wheel went right and I went down the middle. And anyway, I rebuilt this thing. And this time I said to my younger brother, listen, I promise you it works fine. It's perfect. It's built perfect. You take it out for a ride. And he took it for a ride and some local boys pushed him off of the bike and stole the bike. And I remember when my brother came back crying, I was so angry. I was so frustrated. I'd had so much. I was just fed up with the status quo that people could think it's okay to just steal somebody else's property, their hard work, their sweat. I found it so infuriating. And I walked down to the estate that I believe these boys were from. And I walked around the back and sure enough, there was 8 or 9 boys there and they were taking the parts off of this moped that I had bought and put on and spent my time in this freezing cold shed building. They were taking the parts that they wanted. And I mean, it's looking back, it's the stupidest thing to do. You don't walk onto an estate in London or go to another area. You just don't do it. But anyway, I did it. I walked onto this estate. And I walked over to the bike and there was these 8 or 9 boys and they were taking what they wanted. And I held on to the bike and I said, look, I'm taking this bike. It's mine. I'm taking it back. And, you know, something really surprising happened. I had my younger brother with me at the time and there were a few other people around as well. And for the most part, they said, yeah, take it. It's rubbish. We don't want it anyway. And I was a little bit shocked because I was expecting an argument or some pushback, but I didn't get that. So I was taken aback. And at this point, I've won. It's a victory. They've given me back my bike. I should just leave. Anyway, I looked over to the side and there's one guy and he's got a plastic panel about this big.
Like 30 centimeters.
Yeah. Yeah, 30 centimeters or so by about 2-3 centimeters, maybe 2 inches. Mm. And I remember thinking, that's mine. There is no reason why I should leave this with you. It's mine. I want it back. And I walked over and I snatched it out of his hand. And I look back and I think I was really stupid because I could have left. I should have left. But I really just wanted justice. And I took it out of his hand. And I remember this guy, as I turned around to walk away, this guy pushed me. And I turned around and I pushed him back. And I think it was just sheer anger at the situation, frustration at where we'd got to as a society, desperation for change or a need to show my disdain for the kind of status quo that we're living under. Anyway, I pushed him and out of embarrassment, out of pride, I don't know, he walked away and he came back a few minutes later. It must have been about 2 minutes later. At this point, I'm still picking up some of the bits and pieces and I'm putting them onto the moped. And as he walks towards me, I can see in his hand, he's got a loaded gun. And I remember I stood up and I pushed my brother down to the side, just pushed him out of the way. And I stepped away and I had my hands up. And before I could say, you know, you don't have to go that far. He raised the gun and I was looking straight at him and I heard a click. And the thing that I always say is, and this is the absolute truth, when someone's pointing a gun at you, and it makes a sound, it doesn't matter what sound it makes, it sounds like there's a bullet coming towards you. And I remember when he made it the click the first time, he cocked it back and I saw a bullet jump out the side and then he raised it again and he click. And while he was wrestling with it a third time, some of the guys kind of grabbed him and said, "Oh, leave it," you know, and took him away. But I remember thinking, holding myself and checking all over if I'd been shot, because at this stage, he was three and a half, maybe 4 meters away, and he couldn't miss from that range. In my head, I'd heard a sound.
Yeah.
So the gun's fired as far as I'm concerned. I've seen the bullet, so I know it was loaded. And, you know, I checked and I felt tightness in my stomach and my chest where he pointed the gun. And luckily, I mean, there wasn't a round rushing towards me. I didn't get shot. It misfired both times where, I mean, I've never heard of that happening. I'm grateful that it happened.
Yeah.
I remember walking home, which was about a 10-minute walk. And I remember stopping three or four times just to double check if I'd been shot. And I wasn't. But the next thing, which for me was worse than the actual gun itself, was I remember my brother being next to me. And that for me felt terrible that he was in a situation like that. And I felt like I was almost responsible. I built the moped. I allowed him to ride the moped. And he was pushed off of it. And it was taken. And then I walked down onto this estate out of anger and frustration. And he was walking right there behind me. Anyway, to make matters worse, what happened when I got home was I noticed that people were texting me and saying, "Oh, what's going to happen? What are you going to do next? You know, you have to do something." I thought to myself, well, actually, I don't want to do anything because it's going to end really badly for one of us. Either I'm going to end up dead or end up in jail, and neither of those are appealing, or, you know, he's going to end up dead. And I'm not a killer. I don't want to kill anyone. So I decided to switch my phone off and just keep my head down for the next couple of weeks. And after about a week or so, I decided, well, Dwayne, there's a lot of pressure on you to do something. And if you do anything, you're doing it because, well, you're doing it because you want to keep fitting in. You want to stay as part of something.
Yeah.
And that hasn't worked out very well. So what are you going
to
do?
Your friends, your social group, they expected you to retaliate.
Exactly. Exactly. It's about proving how tough you are. And there's nothing about that that proves that you're tough. And I've seen it. I've said it to so many young people. I've seen it from, you know, the side of people who go out and perpetrate these things. I know people who are in prison today because they thought it would make them look tough. I don't know anyone who's in prison because they're tough. I know you're in prison because you've made a mistake or you've made a dumb choice or stupid choice. And I guarantee you wish you could go back and take it back. And I don't want to be any of those people. So at that stage, there was a lot of pressure. I thought, right, if you're going to, you know, you need to be yourself. But I'd been pretending to be someone else for so long now that, well, I genuinely couldn't recognize myself. And I thought, well, the only time I do recognize myself was maybe going back to that 6 or 7 year old kid in the wilderness, in Jamaica, in the fields, in the forest. And that's who I decided to go back to being.
At this moment, Dwayne's and my connection was interrupted. We continued our conversation a few minutes later. You were just elaborating how difficult it actually was to not react, to not give in to that pressure after having done so, after basically having betrayed your true feelings, your true interests and passions for so many years, after trying to belong to that kind of group for so many years. And it was very powerful how you talked about people think they need to be tough, then maybe end up in prison. But actually, if you ended up in prison, that shows that you haven't been tough, that you just made a mistake and you didn't want to be one of these people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, think about it this way, Eric. The hardest decision I ever had to make was the one at the end of, you know, this incident happening, when people were saying, "We know what you should do. You should get this. You should get this person. We can get you this." And in this case, they were talking about, you know, weapons. And I thought to myself, well, actually, I don't want any of those things. And it was really difficult to step away from the thing that I'd wanted to be a part of for the past 10, 12, 13 years. And I think that was harder for me than it would have probably been easier to go and do what they wanted, do what they were suggesting. But I genuinely felt like I had my brother to look out for. And I think you used the word betrayed. I betrayed who I really was. And it really felt like that when I went back to doing things in the outdoors, when I went back to going for walks locally in Epping Forest and woodlands near me, it felt like I was, like I'd apologized to myself as a kid, my inner child. It felt like I'd made up or was making up for lost time, and it felt right and it felt good and it felt like I was doing something positive. So, yeah, betrayal was the right word I think you used there. But I genuinely, look, the thing with this is, I know there are lots of young people who feel the exact same way that I did, who feel that nobody wants to be isolated. We're a social animal, as human species are. We want to be part of things. It hurts when we're not included. And I felt for the first time the pain of not being included didn't feel as bad as the pain of maybe being alone. I think that's what helped my decision.
That helped the decision in that very moment. I think that also helped the decision in the next month and years in terms of in which directions you looked for friends, for meaning, for self-realization, which I believe afterwards changed quite a bit. You already indicated at the fact that you started to look back to nature quite a bit more, to walks and to experience this side of yourself that, of course, was still within yourself, even though it was buried. And I believe, of course, that is a long story that would be worth it to do an extra podcast or even a book or several podcasts about. But it eventually led to you doing something really amazing, which is walking to the North Pole, which I'm sure must have been such a massive adventure for you back then and such a almost reawakening, even though, of course, you never had done anything like that. But I'm sure at the same time, it must have felt, even though this landscape and the eternal ice was so foreign to you, so different from anything you experienced, I'm sure in a certain way, it must have felt like coming home to you.
Oh, it did. It really did. Look, when you love the outdoors, you don't love the outdoors because it's sunny. You don't love the outdoors because it's green or because it's autumn. You might like those aspects of it, but when you love the outdoors, you love it for all aspects, every part of it, warts and all. And for me, I think I needed something bold and something big and something abstract to announce that Dwayne Fields, the little wild feral kid who loved the outdoors, who loved being dirty and muddy and, you know, climbing and scraping. I wanted something big to announce that he was here and he wasn't ashamed of who he was and he was happy to be who he was. And for me, the North Pole presented that opportunity. So when I heard about the opportunity to take to go on an expedition to the magnetic North Pole, I thought, wow. It sounds like they're actually calling my name. It sounds like they're actually saying, Dwayne Fields, this is your ticket. This is, you need to do this. So when I said yes, and I wrote back in that email, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. In fact, I'll tell you what I did actually. When I heard about this opportunity, the first thing I did was I did a whole lot of research, which amounted to about 5 minutes on Google. That's what it was. And I just clicked through and I clicked through and I clicked through. And that's what I learned about the North Pole as a whole. So it was, when you say it was a foreign environment, it absolutely was. It was a completely alien space. The temperatures I'd never experienced before. The environment, it was so barren. There was nothing there to be seen unless you took a moment and really looked, because there was lots of life. There were polar bears. There was, I found a pet muskox. I had a muskox while I was up there, young muskox, baby muskox. And, you know, interestingly, when I posted, I think I posted a image of me and this muskox somewhere or a message about it. My sister, my older sister said, well, I expected nothing less from you, because she knows if it's there, I will find it and I will find a way to bring it home or to make it mine. Or, you know, there's a saying, there's this thing in with naturalists and outdoor enthusiasts that you leave nature alone. I try so hard. I try so hard, but I always find myself like trying to get as close as possible. And I have to actively tell myself, nope, just observe. And sometimes I get caught out. I tried to help this muskox because it was stuck on a ledge and I rescued it. And then it decided that I was now mum. So, you know, as much as I try not to engage, I sometimes let that little kid in me get out.
I know it's a big question and probably almost impossible to answer. But given that you have such a strong connection to nature and have had that connection from early childhood days, how would you characterize that connection? What do you feel in nature? Why do you love to be out there?
It's the first environment that I remember. That's what I'm going to say. It's very familiar to me, no matter where it is. If I've got nothing but sky above my head, it feels very familiar to me. It could be a place I've never visited before, but I remember being a kid. I remember being as young as 2 years old. And walking, I remember walking in the within the trees really close to the house. I remember being able to climb trees before I'd ever seen a house with more than two floors. I remember climbing trees or being in, walking in mud and puddles and walking through streams before I'd ever sat in a car. I remember climbing a tree because I saw a lizard before I'd ever eaten a cheeseburger. I remember, these things are more, they're more familiar to me than many other things that I've experienced. And I think that's what it is. I think they were just familiar to me at the time that I was most, I was at my, most influenceable. It's very familiar to me, whether I'm in a jungle or a desert. Just being outside and being within a natural space just feels very, very homely to me.
And how important is the aspect of being challenged for that feeling of feeling home? Of course, nature, you can experience nature in so many ways, right?
A
stroll, you can meditate on a grassland, or you can really set out there and look for friction and do something hard. Exactly.
I think the challenge is where the growth happens. I could very happily go for a stroll and sit on a, grassy knoll or walk up a hill. But I think the challenge is where I grow and where I get better, and where I get stronger and where I become more appreciative. And it's where I become more confident and more daring. And I think as a being, as an individual, it's all about how can you improve yourself? And I think through challenges, we can improve ourselves. So that's why challenge isn't necessary. It doesn't have to be a part of it. It doesn't have to be. But when they do come, you take those opportunities, you learn. There's no losses. You learn and you improve.
What would you say you learned from the challenge of walking to the North Pole?
I learned that I could do a lot more than I ever believed I could. I learned that regardless of the external, and that could be the temperature, that could be the wind, that could be the risk of polar bear, that could be the ice cracking, that could be all of those things combined. You are stronger than you can imagine is what I learned. I learned that all the things that that would have stopped me prior to making that choice to go there existed. And I learned that I overcame all of those.
That is great. Yeah. And it was such a huge success for you personally, I believe. Not only did you find out you were able to do this, to meet this challenge, to overcome these obstacles, but you also received so much praise afterwards. You received an invitation from the Queen, and there were a lot of amazing experiences that propelled you forward as a result from daring to participate in this thing that you didn't really understand even when you agreed to do that. You mentioned you only Googled it for 5 minutes. What would you say, how did this experience shape what you wanted to come next in your life, what you wanted from your life for yourself?
Let me be clear. When I first said I was going to go to the North Pole, I said it quietly. I wasn't confident about the idea. I didn't want anyone to shut it down. I equally didn't expect any kind of praise. I just wanted to do something to prove to my peer group, the people I grew up around and others, that you don't have to just look internally. There's a whole world out there. I didn't expect any interviews on TV or radio or the Queen. I didn't expect any of it. I didn't even think that far ahead. I just thought, I want to do this thing to shout to the world, look at this cool thing. I've just done it. If I can do it, you can do it too. Now, how it shaped me was the more that I did was the more I realized doors and opportunities kept opening up. No, let me be clear. The more that I did was the more I realized these opportunities existed. Because they were always there, but I just couldn't see them. And the more I did, the more I realized, actually, I can open doors or present opportunities for other people, which is why I do so much work with the We Too Foundation and young people on the whole. And which is why I go and I speak to colleges, schools, youth groups, even prisons I go and speak in, because many times people don't see these opportunities because, well, they're head down for a variety of reasons. It could be day-to-day challenges. It could be that they're struggling with work. It could be that they never thought about it before. And I think it's my duty, if I've been through something and I've made, I think, a good enough run at it, I think it's my duty to present it to others to say, look at this cool thing that you could be doing. If you do this, you'll get to go out into the wilderness and wild spaces and natural spaces, and you will fall in love with nature. And if you fall in love with it, you will protect it. And I think that's fundamentally what we want to do here, isn't it? Get people to appreciate these spaces.
Yeah, what you're telling me right now reminds me in parts of an interview I did a few months ago with Danny Trejo, the actor. Okay. I don't know if you know him. Machete, he's the record holder in the Guinness Book for the most deaths on screen because he always plays the bad guy, which he does so well because he used to be the bad guy for decades.
You know, I'm going to look it up. Yeah, I'm gonna look this up.
Look, he has an amazing life story. He was in prison for decades. He was a drug addict. He was a drug dealer. He was really violent, really bad guy. And fast forward, he's now I think almost 80. He has been clean and sober and out of prison for decades as well, and has been doing so much good work. Not only becoming a really successful Hollywood actor, working with almost anyone you can imagine, but especially using the experiences he gained from all of this to go back to the places that he experienced basically from the perspective of being these places' victim. Like he was, it sounds so obvious when you say, of course, you know, there's a whole world out there and you can go into nature, you can have these experiences as well. But if you grow up in a home of violence or drug addiction or in a neighborhood that is really rough and you don't have these role models. Yeah.
You can't see outside of that. You're just thinking about the next meal, or you're thinking about, if you can even think about the next day, because I've worked with young people who struggle to think beyond, you know, lunchtime because they have it so tough. And, you know, if I'm honest, there are times in my life where I was homeless. I didn't have a penny in my pocket and I was sleeping on a train. I would walk all night so I wouldn't have to sleep because I was afraid of what would happen if I did fall asleep. So I know the struggles that people go through when they say they can't think beyond the situation they're in. And I think it's all our responsibilities to do something to try and make it a better world. But sorry, go ahead. I jumped in there.
No worries. Yeah. And something that fits very well, that whole topic that we're talking about, is a little quote from your website. It says, breaking the norm, breaking expectations.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that? Which kind of expectations do you want to break?
I want to break the expectations. This is a really simple one. So what's normal for me might not be normal for somebody else. And if they're not happy with what is normal for them, it can be challenging sometimes to break out of that cycle. And because of the norms that we have in our own lives, sometimes we put expectations on ourselves. Sometimes other people place expectations on us and we try and live up to them, rightly or wrongly. A good example is, I remember when I was a kid, I was told, get a trade, which for some people might be perfectly fine, but for me, it just didn't fit. And I tried my hardest to live up to that expectation, to the point where I spent 3 years, a year at college, 3 years working for the London Underground before I decided, actually, that's not the direction I wanted. That's 4 years of my time that I could have spent doing something that I felt like I was happy with. So it's all about breaking what norms you're not happy with. And I think further to that, there's live outside the box as well. If you're in a space that you don't want to be in and you feel like you're trapped, you're in a box. Try and get out of that box by breaking them norms and breaking those expectations that you don't agree with.
And you broke these expectations that people and yourself probably had for yourself. You left this box and you did that, for example, most recently with your new TV series, Seven Toughest Days. The German version of it is called Die Sieben Härtesten Tage. Tell us about that new show. What is it about?
I'm glad. So Seven Toughest Days is all about me going to some of the hardest, toughest environments on the planet at the toughest times of year and navigating my way through these environments using things that I've picked up along the way. So it could have been something that I learned as a kid. It could be me just looking at the gear that I've got and saying, I'm going to use this in a slightly different way. It could be me looking at it and saying, well, actually, I remember seeing something like this on TV years ago. It's about using the skills that I have, not the ones that I've been, you know, taught in the military or learned through some survival course. It's all about using what I know, what I've learned, what I've seen in day-to-day life, my day-to-day life, and applying it to the situation. We go to some of the most incredible spaces. We're in, you know, the massive, it's a sea of sand dunes in Oman.
Yeah.
We go to the thickest jungles in the world. Like Gabon is one of the most forested countries in the world. And as far as the eye can see, it's jungle. And we navigate our way through that jungle, through the rain, through the rivers, and we make it to a tiny airfield in the middle there to get rescued or to get taken out. We go to Kyrgyzstan, which is one of the most mountainous countries in the world. We're at, you know, 4,000 feet. It's minus 30 almost. And we're trying to make our way across the, through the mountains, across the plateau and down to civilization eventually. And it is as hard as it looks. It really is as hard as it looks. And these were really tough for me. And I hope the viewer, one, gets to see some beautiful environments. Mm-hmm. Two, gets to identify with me because again, I embody the person sat at home in this. I'm somebody coming from a space of, well, I have some experience, but I'm not an expert. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people sat at home are exactly that person. And I guess it makes them feel like there's somebody rooting for them.
Yeah, indeed. It's a perfect mixture, I think, because in some sense, the show reminds me a little bit, in the best sense, of the earlier Bear Grylls shows where you really struggle with nature and look for challenges as a way to grow and also to just have fun. But at the same time, you are not pretending to be the expert in everything that you encounter, but you feel challenged and you're happy to show that.
I know and love Bear Grylls. Bear Grylls, I'm one of his biggest fans.
Yeah.
I will never have the skill set that Bear Grylls has. Let's just put that. Yeah. It's taken him a lifetime to develop his skill set. I will never have it. But the key thing here is this show, it's all about just an almost average person being in these environments and utilizing what we all have, which is some imagination, hopefully some cord and some very basic survival skills. And I think that's what we do really well. And we take the view on a journey as well. I try and put as much of me and my own experiences into the show as possible. By that, I mean, I tell anecdotes from my own story, my own background, and I hopefully bring the view in because it's all about telling stories. And that's one thing I'm passionate about, sharing stories.
Sharing stories and sharing your passion for nature. And you mentioned the beautiful place Gabon and the massive jungles there. And I remember the very first scene of that episode. In it, we see you in a pack raft on a river in this jungle, and the roaring water carries you faster and faster. And you say something like, "Wow, now I am really out of my comfort zone." So, as we just said, you don't pretend it's all easy for you.
No.
Can you describe the situation? What exactly brought you out of your comfort zone, and why do you seem to enjoy that so much?
Well, you know, when you're on the edge of something, you get that little rush in your stomach or in your chest. I actually like being in that place because to me, that feels like I'm improving. This feels like fertile ground to grow in. Now, what took me out of my comfort zone in that scene, because I remember it really well. In one moment, we're paddling along this river. And yes, sure enough, there is a film crew there, but they, for the most part, they leave me alone as much as they can, or they pretty much leave me alone. We're paddling along and everything's fine. Now, I've never been on this river before, and the river conditions change based on rainfall. Now, Gabon gets some of the highest levels of rainfall anywhere in the world. What we found was I was paddling along and the river narrows. And if it narrows, it speeds up. The water speeds up. It has same volume of water, has to get through, speeds up. And what we found was we were heading towards a waterfall. Now, I like to think we had enough lead time to see it and hear it and, you know, get to safety. But there were hairy moments. And I think the series is littered with hairy moments just like that one. For example, I'm going to take you away from Gabon and take you to Oman, where I make mistakes in this series. And that's one thing that I was mindful and the director and producers were mindful of. We're not going to sugarcoat any mistakes that you make. Mm. And I made a mistake during the opening scenes in Oman. I got fed up with the boat driver who wouldn't stop. I kept saying, "Look, can we stop there?" And he'd say, "No, no, no." And I started to think, well, maybe there's a language barrier here. And I'd say, "Can we stop there?" And he'd say, "No, no, no." And it got to the point where we were almost moving away from the beach. And I decided just to chuck my bag out and jump out after it. I tied a cord to the bag and I started swimming into land, and the cord got wrapped around my feet. And I was, you know, trying to paddle and kick, and it was becoming harder and harder. And looking back, that was a very stupid thing to do. And again, frustration and eagerness to just hit the road and get moving and make progress going the way. And those moments, it's kept in because, you know, we make errors, we make mistakes. And that's the honest version of that's the honesty of the show. We're trying to be as honest as editorially we can be. We're showing errors. We're showing the good bits as well. We're showing the funny moments. We're showing the moments where I win. I remember, you know, coming across water in the desert. And that was like a, whoa, this is a really cool thing.
Yes.
Unexpected moments, they happen. And I genuinely hope the viewer watches this and can see that these moments are moments where I'm genuinely, I don't know, emotional, whether it's a positive emotion or frustration. I hope they go on that emotional journey with me.
And this journey, of course, doesn't only include misery and challenge,
no.
And as I said, these magic moments as well, but they also include, of course, interacting with some of the locals. You mentioned the boat driver in Oman. Well, that interaction didn't go that well, but of course, there are many more of those. For example, to come back one last time to the Gabon episode.
Oh, yes.
I remember you meeting the Baka,
my
I think
favorite
it's pronounced.
Moment.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yes.
Who are they? How did you meet them?
So the Baka people are one of the oldest tribes anywhere in Africa. Mm-hmm. They're among the oldest. They've been living in and around the Gabonese jungle for around 4,000 years now. And they're these small communities that will travel. They're nomadic. So they travel around the jungle, use the resources, but don't deplete them. And then they move on again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my guide, the person who gave me some advice prior to setting out in the jungle, is a guy called Gislaine. Gislaine said, there are people in the jungle who are there for wrong reasons, nefarious reasons, poachers. He said, the best thing you can do is call out. If you come across people in the jungle, if they live there and you call out, you'll be fine because they won't see you as a poacher.
Yeah.
So I called out to these Baka people when I heard the noises, and I didn't know what to do when they called back to me. And I remember walking into their small settlement, and I know the language spoken there is broken French.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to use my best French, Eric. And I said to one of the community that came over to me, I said, my name is Hungry. Now, this was a combination of my nerves. This was a combination of fatigue. This was a combination of my bad French.
Yeah.
But, you know, these are the kind of things that happen in the show. And they happened in my life while I was there. So they are present in the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a beautiful moment because they all looked at me. You've got 25, 30 people staring at me. And I was like, right, what other words do I know in French? And before I knew it, these people were so beautiful. They gave me the time to try and figure out my words. And eventually they said they understood that I was, you know, not a threat. And I was saying hungry. So they took me down to this tiny stream and they showed me how to fish in the mud to you know, set up some kind of dam and then dredge through the mud to find small fish. And then they roasted these fish and we ate, and they sent me on my way. And it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, so as we can see, there's a lot in that show, in the different episodes that it contains in its first season. I'm just thinking back to what you said earlier on, that when you go to schools and to prison, you try to show them that they can. It's worth it to try to break norms or the expectations that others have towards you, that you may have towards yourself, and that nature can be, doesn't have to be, but can be a part of that, because it takes you out of your ordinary environment and challenges you in new ways, for example. Is that about what you want to show with this particular show as well? I mean, now it's almost a rhetorical question, but maybe you want to answer it like, what is important about it for you? What do you want to show with it?
Well, I think the most important thing in this show is one, the environment.
Mm-hmm.
We're lucky enough, fortunate enough to get to work in some of the most beautiful environments anywhere in the world. And I'm hopeful that we showcase that really well with the shots that you see in the series. Equally, I want people to see me as them. See me as you. It doesn't matter if you're a little girl, a little black kid, white kid. It does not matter at all. I want you to look at me and say, well, actually, if that guy can do it and he grew up in relatively similar, so maybe I can do it too. That's what I want people to take. You know, we've had TV shows where it's this typical middle-aged ex-military man that's been doing these things. And it's great because we learn lots. But what I think is a lot of people see that and think, yeah, but they can do it. I can't do that because I don't come from where they come from. I haven't had the training. And I want people to think, well, actually, with a little bit of consideration and a few steps to make yourself safe, you could do something like this too. And that's what I really want to showcase.
And I think the beautiful thing about that is that you are in part particularly able to do that because of your background, because you had these first few years in Jamaica where the roots of your passion for nature have been implanted in you. But you also grew up many years in London in a completely different world as a completely different person with different friends and so on. So you also understand that world that is really disconnected from nature. So something that meant a lot of struggles for you, a lot of insecurity, a lot of effort, try to find who you are, what you want to do. Actually, as far as I can judge it, as an outsider who doesn't know you all that well, but based on our conversation,
you know me well enough.
I feel that all of these challenges that were really personal and deep challenges, you mentioned you were almost like borderline depressed as a child, that they actually enabled you to do what you do today, which is something that you really seem to love and that you seem to be really good at and successful in.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, look, every single thing that happens in our lives plays a part in making us who we are today. So I completely agree. But the key thing here is I want everyone to walk away from this and start looking at the opportunities that are ahead of them and maybe start taking a few. Fear is the thing that holds us. I did a series called Welcome to Earth. I worked on a series with Will Smith. Mm-hmm. Now, Will said something to me. It's on Disney Plus as well. He said something to me that I'd heard before, but I'd never really thought about it. He said the best things in life, and this is what he heard from his grandma, the best things in life are on the other side of fear. Mm. And I want everyone to just think about that. If it frightens you, there's probably something good on the other side of that, or something good to come out of that.
I think that is a beautiful thought to take away from this conversation and a beautiful final word for it. So thank you so much for making the time to talk to me and to sharing these experiences with our audience. Thank you, Dwayne.
Thank you so much.
All the best and good luck with the show. Hopefully there will be more episodes coming in the future. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.